The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent, including Olas Media.
Olas Media. Olas Media presents Nation State of Play.
Welcome to the Nation State of Play podcast. I'm your host, Brian Miller. On each episode, we explore the political stories that are driving public policy in California. We explore these stories with political insiders, business leaders, journalists, and policymakers themselves to get below the surface of the headlines and show you the true forces shaping our nation state. Thanks so much for listening today. We have one of my favorite repeat guests on, Tiffany Muller, who runs End Citizens United. This is an organization that had their hands in so many races across the country this cycle. And we had her on a few weeks before the election to talk about what she was focused on. So in this conversation, do a little bit of an election recap, but spend most of our time on what's ahead for 2023 and even 2024. And how dark money, big money made an impact in the last cycle, but also how the concern about democracy is really starting to become first and foremost to candidates and voters across the country. So Tiffany's really the expert in these issues across the entire country, and she's got some great insights on what candidates can do, but also what voters should be paying attention to. So stay with us, Tiffany Muller with End Citizens United, right after this.
American democracy is good, but we can make it better. The National Association of Nonpartisan Reformers includes organizations across the country that are working right now to build a better democracy by opening primaries, implementing safe, secure voting systems, reducing corruption, and increasing transparency. Listen to our weekly podcast, How to Win Friends and Save the Republic, to hear the latest updates from the democracy reform space. Subscribe and learn more about us at nonpartisanreformers.org.
Welcome back to the Nation State of Play podcast. Tiffany, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Really lucky to have you to talk a little bit of recap and what's ahead for 2023. So we appreciate you being here.
Thanks so much for having me back on, Brian. I really appreciate it.
All right, so you were here a couple weeks before the election. We had a chance to talk about a bunch of races. You had your hands in across the country, a lot of interesting stuff. And so I'm curious, what was your election night like? What were you watching most carefully? What was on your constant refresh screen on your computer early in the night as you're trying to figure out where things were headed?
Well, Brian, our whole team had gathered to watch the election results come in. And as those first election results came in, I remember making this speech to the team about why we do the work we do, and that it really matters that we fight for the vision of our country that we believe in, that we fight for our democracy, even when the outcomes are not guaranteed, right? Which they never are in an election. And by the way, that's the speech you give when you're pretty sure the election night is going to be bad and you want to keep your team motivated. And then as we start watching, I mean, obviously, one of the first things that rolls in is Florida. Florida always feels bad.
Right.
But then outside of that, there were lots of really hopeful signs, right? Some of the races that we were watching most closely that felt like they were going to be real bellwethers of how the night was going to go were coming in strong, much stronger than I think we had thought that they would initially. Example, Abigail Spanberger in Virginia 7. That yeah. felt like a race that was really going to tell us what kind of night we were going to have. The Pennsylvania Senate race, obviously, with Fetterman. These were races that we were watching really closely and trying to get a sense of where the election was going. Michigan was another one where, you know, just up and down the ballot, we were so fully invested in Michigan that we were really watching how close were those elections going to be, and what did it mean for across the country. And honestly, I think that we had been saying over and over again, voters are really concerned about democracy and democracy is on the ballot and it's going to show up on election night. But I think that we underestimated how right we were about that, right? So whether it is the fact that we actually gained a seat in the Senate, or we picked up four legislative chambers across the country, or that we held every single incumbent Democratic governor, or that we just had a complete clean sweep of the Secretary of State and AG races and battleground states across the country against massive election deniers, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever kind of metric you're looking at, Democrats and democracy had a historic performance on election night.
Yeah, I mean, so many things there I'd love to unpack, but let's talk about that AG and Secretary of State story, because I do think maybe that's the one that speaks, you know, most directly to election deniers and democracy, and also is of course just not going to get covered as much as high profile Senate and House races and governor's races. But I was really heartened to see that too. What were the states in those races that you were looking at the most closely?
Yeah, we were involved in, I think, about 16 races overall. 14 of those ended up being wins. But the big states I was watching most closely were the Secretary of State and AG races in Michigan, Arizona, and Nevada. And, you know, we also were watching, of course, Wisconsin and Colorado and Georgia, but really that Nevada and Arizona and Michigan, those were the three that we were paying the most attention to. And what we saw in those states were election deniers on the other side, people who are extremists on both overturning elections, denying the outcome of the 2020 election, and really extremists on almost every other issue that voters care about. And in many of those states, whether Michigan or Arizona in particular, you also had these top of the ticket races that were really, really expensive. And so it was really hard to cut through a media market that was that crowded, right? Yeah. In Arizona, you had $200 million Senate race, plus a really competitive governor's race. And yet it was Adrian Fontes, the Secretary of State candidate, who actually got the most votes on the Democratic side of the ticket. There's no way that happens unless voters are really prioritizing someone who's going to protect their vote at the ballot box as one of their main issues of concern. And that's what we saw happening all across the country. And we actually went in right after the election and did a post-election poll, and it backed up those findings, right? That, yeah, we were seeing it anecdotally in election turnout, but what we found is that voters listed, without being prompted, just an open end, why was this election more important than previous elections? Protecting democracy was the biggest issue that they just in an open end said. And by a 10-point margin, voters trusted Democrats more than Republicans to stand up to the threats to democracy. And it was a really key reason why we were able to actually win these independent voters in races across the country. So I just think that those races, those Secretary of State races in particular, is a place where it just became so crystal clear.
Yeah, I love the Arizona example. And speaking on the AG race, I don't know what the betting odds of Chris Mays would becoming the Arizona Attorney General were, but my guess is they were, you know, let's just say lower than the 49ers winning the Super Bowl. and she's, God, she's amazing. We got to work with her years ago when she was back on the Arizona Corporation Commission. But I think you've pulled out such a good example there of a state that, you know, still has some pretty hard right elements. And the fact that Secretary of State candidate gets more than even Mark Kelly, I think that what a great example of how this stuff was playing out. So clearly, it was moving Democrats. It was moving independents. Was it moving Republicans at all?
Even Republicans are concerned about it, right? Even so, our poll found that 69% of Republicans and independents who voted for a Democratic House candidate actually said that protecting democracy was extremely important. So, you always peel off some amount of Republicans, not that many. But in this election, what we found were that the Republicans that we were able to peel off, that democracy was what was motivating them to vote for a Democratic candidate.
Yeah, I have a colleague who's always making this point. He's like, look, you can look at the numbers that peel Republicans off on any particular issue. They could sound really small. It could be in the single percents. It could be even below 5%. But those are the kind of numbers that change election outcomes in a world of close elections, right? So it's just that little bit around the margin. That's the difference between winning a Georgia Senate race, for instance, right?
Or up and down
the tickets. So
that's exactly right.
Yeah, so those little numbers, great to see. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to add, in races where it wasn't a Democratic candidate versus Republican candidate, so the democracy ballot measures that were across the country as well, we saw those win by massive margins, right? In Arizona, the dark money measure, getting rid of dark money, making sure that there's disclosure about who is funding our elections, that was the top vote getter because it pulled a lot of Republicans over. And what we saw was across the country, every single democracy ballot measure won, whether that was in Arizona or in Michigan or in Oakland, California, where they instituted democracy vouchers. Across the country, we saw these democracy ballot measures really do very, very well.
Well, it's a perfect segue to the next question I want to ask you, which is, what do those results, those outcomes suggest to you about strategies going forward? Should we be pushing for more ballot measures about democracy? I'm sure you would think we should be talking about these issues more generally. How do you look back at the cycle and say, okay, this worked with certain demographics, this worked in certain states, and how does that inform your strategies going forward?
Yeah, I think that we should always be looking for opportunities to put democracy on the ballot because it is a winning issue and a good motivator and the right policy. As you know, ballot measures are not always easy to get funded, to get the signatures, to get on the ballot. But in the places where we are able to do that and are able to get them on the ballot, I think that again, this past cycle, we had a really good instruction manual of how to do this. You know, in Michigan, they solidified and put into their constitution the expansion of voting rights. In Arizona, it was about dark money. In Oakland, it was about, you know, public financing. Anything that is shoring up people's power in our democracy is really popular and doing great. And we've seen that for the last few cycles. So I think we should absolutely be looking at where are there opportunities where we can continue to push that and expand that. But I think you're right on your other point as well, Brian, which is that we also need to make sure that candidates have the resources they need in order to continue to run on and talk about these issues, because they are really important to voters. And I think, you know, in 2018, we did a great job making sure that candidates had the resources they needed to be able to talk about corruption and to talk about money in politics. But throughout this past cycle, I think sometimes there was a sense of, well, what does democracy mean to voters, right? Is it money? Is it corruption? Is it voting? Is it overturning elections? And the answer is yes. The answer is it is actually all of those things to voters. And so we are working, we're working constantly to make sure that we have the most up-to-date research and that we actually are being able to provide candidates and committees with the guidance that they need to feel really confident and really comfortable talking about these issues in their campaigns, because it's going to continue to be a huge issue. I mean, the front runner for the 2024 GOP nomination is the ringleader of the threats to our democracy, right? Mm-hmm. They are not going to let up with election denialism, even though it just costs them at the ballot box. So we're going to have to continue to make sure voters understand that contrast and understand what's at stake and continue to feel the urgency that they clearly did in this election.
Yeah. So interesting when we think about the 2024 issues. But let me turn our attention to the states here, because as you pointed out, some really huge progress in places like Michigan and Arizona and other states at the state level, which gives you some opportunities now to really be proactive. And you guys have some great resources online with the state report card you do, talking about democracy in the states. So yeah, tell me, as we go into 2023, how do you think about the landscape for your priorities with these legislative sessions and potentially things that can be done with Executive Act?
Yeah, I mean, I think that first, we have to do the deeper dives that we were just talking about in 2023 around the research, around the policies. But we also know that we're going to have to immediately defend against some of the attacks that we'll see in Republican trifecta states, right? I think in 2022, there were somewhere close to 300 bills introduced that were aimed at rolling back the right to vote. We've seen 80 of those become law in the past 2 years. So we know that first and foremost, we're going to have to continue to fight back against some of those. And then looking toward 2024, I think it continues to be, how do we drive the messaging around everything from money in politics to anti-corruption, to voting rights, to making sure our elections are safe and secure? And how do we, it's going to be hard to get anything passed on the federal level. How do we use that messaging to help us win the House back in 2024? But on the state level, thanks for mentioning the state democracy scorecard. I think that the state democracy scorecard does a great job of laying out a roadmap for state legislators who are concerned about these issues to start to look for places that they can improve their own state. We looked at ethics and anti-corruption, at money in politics, at voting rights, at redistricting, and basically looked at a state, every state, and put together a comprehensive kind of democracy score. And so there are some places that have really great scores around, say, voting rights and voting access, but could actually still do some work around money and politics. And so in those cases, we're looking at, okay, who are the state legislators that really want to take a lead? How do we work with them? How do we activate our members across the country to help drive those agendas forward?
Yeah, I love this report card. Let's put a link to it in the show notes. It does a great job of digesting a lot of information in a really, really easy to read and make sense of format. So compliments to your team and you for putting this together. And if we could, I'd love to pull out an example along the lines of what you just mentioned here in our state of California, because this is an example of where we're doing most things right, but not everything as well as we could have. And that never sits right with California exceptionalism here. So let's talk about. But let me just give kind of a summary of what you're saying, and then we'll show some of the areas you flag for improvement. So good on voting rights laws, good on democracy subversion protections. One thing you have flagged here in California, though, is that we have high contribution limits for individuals, PACs, and corporations, which can open the door to undue influence from big money donors and special interests. So in an ideal world, what would you want to see on this issue in California?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, first, California overall, you all should be incredibly proud of the score that you have and the strong democracy score overall. I think it's like fourth overall. But it's really the campaign finance and ethics scores that take a hit because of those high contribution limits and because of a lack of some cooling off periods for the revolving door between government and lobbying. And so, you know, there are things that we're seeing happen in California. Number one, we could pass lower contribution limits, more disclosure, also making sure that lobbyists don't have undue influence. So implement a cooling off period of at least 2 years after legislators have left office. But we've also been seeing cities in California really take the lead on trying to root out big money in politics. And so you've seen Los Angeles, San Francisco, Long Beach all pass public campaign financing programs. And then Oakland just this year passed the Democracy Dollars program, and it passed with 74% of the vote. What's great about these programs is obviously it makes sure that no matter, you know, who you are or what your network is, you are able to run for office, and you can do it without depending on money from special interests, and you can really empower grassroots donors. What we've seen in other cities where they've implemented this is actually more people participating in democracy, from voting to contributions, that it actually brings more people into the system, which is what we should be aiming to do. So, you know, California could also look at passing a statewide public campaign financing program in order to take the lessons learned on the city level and implement them statewide.
Yeah. Let me ask you about one more specific bill you flagged in California, and then I want to ask you about that, the statewide financing issues. But I hadn't heard of this before, and I thought this was really interesting in your report, that there was a bill pending in 2022 in California called the Stop Foreign Influence in California Elections Act. I take it that didn't pass. Is that right?
I believe that is correct. And this is actually something that the FEC even just put out their recommendations for the year. So on the national level, it's something that we're working on too. Here's the thing. We've been seeing a lot of foreign companies and individuals get involved in ballot measures across the country. Right. So foreign companies and foreign nationals can't contribute to candidates or political committees, but guess what? They can actually get involved in ballot measures. And that's what we've been seeing happen. And so it's a loophole in our campaign finance system that was never meant to be that way. Mm-hmm. And so we are advocating at both the national and in the state level to crack down on that and to make sure that the laws around that are really clear and that we outlaw any foreign interference in our elections, including in our ballot measures. We've seen this play out in Montana, in Maine, obviously California, which has been looking at addressing it. So we need to pass it at both the national and at the state law levels.
Yeah, I mean, perfect segue for what I wanted to ask you about next, because this ballot measure issue in California, I think for every Californian who sees these ads over and over in every cycle and is surrounded by this noise, and certainly those of us who work in the space, we just have this sense that this has gone off the rails here. And we've really gotten into this situation where there's essentially two legislative bodies. There's the legislature, and then there's this whole ballot measure process. And we have dozens of measures that try to qualify each year, and usually over a dozen that'll ultimately make it. But we've created this sort of moral hazard in the legislature, is the only way I can describe it, where really tough decisions are being punted to the ballot. And members are kind of using the ballot process as a way to hide behind things like tax increases or tough votes that might upset a particular constituency. And it's all just creating this sort of vacuum of making the hard decisions out of Sacramento and going to the ballot, which on the one hand you could argue, hey, maybe that's good. Maybe that's direct democracy. Maybe this is, you know, maybe this is ancient Greece where we all get together and vote. But I think the reality that we know is quite different. I mean, we just had two competing ballot measures on gaming spend over $200 million, and they both lost by double digits. But just it's got to be the highest in American history. I'll nail that down. But we've just gotten into these crazy, crazy spending numbers. And as you said, if that's open to foreign governments, then we've got this whole system of loopholes. So, you know, where do you come down on the ballot measure thing? I mean, on the one hand, you could, like you said, you could argue this is good for democracy. On the other hand, when the numbers get so high, particularly in big states, it could be really bad for democracy. So how do you think about it?
Yeah, $200 million for a ballot measure.
Crazy.
I mean, it is shocking to me how much money what this midterm ended up being, somewhere around $9 billion in total for our midterms. And the kind of money that we couldn't even have imagined, even in presidential campaigns, less than 10 years ago. Yeah. And I think, to your point, it you have a couple of things happening. One, obviously, we think legislators should be making decisions. That is what our system is set up to do. We elect representatives at the state and national level, and they are supposed to make decisions. We often see special interest in big money, frankly, gridlocking our systems of democracy, right? And Congress, we can talk about this all the time, where, you know, prescription drug prices are constantly being blocked by big pharma, right? And so if you have these big special interests on both sides, and then things are just being kicked to the ballot, and then you have hundreds of millions of dollars being run up in election spending through ballot measures, it just continues to drive a lot of the problems that we are seeing in our elections and in our democracy. And it continues to alienate people from feeling like their voice matters and that they can be involved and can make a difference. And on the other hand, you have other states that are trying to keep anything from being able to go to the ballot. Mm-hmm. They're creating processes that are so hard that there is no way to collect and defend the signatures to actually get on the ballot. Or they're creating subject matters that are so narrow that you can't actually, pass it and get on the ballot. So I think that we have to be willing to reform our systems as we see them getting out of whack and pulling power away from people, right? Like, that's always what I try to think about, which is, how do we make sure that people are having power and voice and vote in our system? And when ballot measures are one more way that they're being drowned out, then we should reform it. I guess that's where I fell on it. To be fair, without having done much study, without having, I am not an expert in California's ballot measures by any means, but I do think that it's good mostly when we can have things on the ballot and the people can weigh in, but not when it's at the expense of people being able to have voice in their democracy and being drowned out by big money.
So a difficult balance to strike. I mean, I really struggle with whether it should be a simple majority or a 60% or something like that threshold too. You see so many of these measures kind of in that area between 50 and 60. And I sort of hope that our members and legislators can get back to the concept of a representative democracy on the really tough stuff. And then, when we need to amend the Constitution, when we need to do things that are sort of structural to particular states' laws that have been part of the fabric of the way we do things, it makes sense to me that those should go to the ballot. But
go ahead. I was just going to say, in some states too, even when we've seen, we had Missouri a couple of years ago that passed a really great comprehensive kind of democracy reform measure, and then the state legislature just completely gutted it, right? So we've seen that happen across the country too. And every time these things happen, I also think it is one more example of why we need national standards across our country, national standards for voting, national standards around money in our system, and because the one-offs that we're seeing kind of around the country make it more and more difficult to really have people feel empowered across the country, because you see some states rolling back democracy, some states trying to expand it in herky jerky ways, and we really do need some national standards.
Yeah, I mean, it would be so much better in so many ways. And let's talk about that. What are the biggest areas when you look at your state report cards every year that you see states falling down in? What are the common things that keep coming up that you want to see them do better at?
Well, this is a new report. We just put it out for the first time this past year. So what I'm interested in seeing is the movement and the progress that states end up making. I mean, I think for a lot of states, there's still a lot of room that they can grow on the voting access side, everything from automatic voter registration to at least 14 days of early voting to no excuse absentee mail-in ballot voting, right? There's still a lot of states that can make those kind of changes, which we know really impacts people's ability to turn out. And then on kind of the ethics and the money and politics side, you have a lot of states where there could be more disclosure, cracking down on that revolving door between lobbyists and government, actually having an ethics commission that has some teeth and can actually hold folks accountable to the state laws. Because to varying degrees, a lot of the state ethics enforcement agencies are pretty weak. And there's also a lot of states that have a lot of coordination allowed between basically dark money groups and candidates. And so some additional disclosure, transparency, and cracking down on that coordination.
So I want to ask you about Supreme Court reform.
Fun. Okay. Of course.
And this has just become such a disturbing issue over the last few months as we've seen all these stories about whether it's, you know, Jenny Thomas being involved in January 6th or, you know, this weird lobbying story, which maybe we could talk about a little bit more. But yeah, I'm in the car with my mom the other day. And she's like, we should have an age limit for members of the Supreme Court. She's well above whatever that age limit would be. But by the way, personally, and I thought, well, you know, I was kind of conflicted about that. You know, the founders put that in there for a reason. And I know there's been a lot of reform ideas thrown around, but it does really seem like the body has become so politicized, and your organization is named after a famous Supreme Court case. So how do you think about where we are with the Supreme Court right now? What do you think it needs to be done structurally, if anything?
I think that the Supreme Court is going to be known for two things when we look back on it. One is obviously overturning of Roe, right? The Dobbs decision. And the second is the attacks that they have perpetrated against our democracy for more than a decade, right? From Citizens United to Shelby v. Holder to Janus decision weakening worker power, to the other voting rights and gerrymandering cases that we have seen, where time and time again they are ruling on behalf of the special interest and not on behalf of the people. And yeah, we are named End Citizens United because we think that the Citizens United decision was one of the most damaging and terrible ones in our history, and that it allowed our system to become so flooded and overwhelmed with unlimited and undisclosed money that our democracy can't really work like it's supposed to. So yeah, we have come out in favor of Supreme Court reform, and we think that it needs to be a pretty comprehensive reform. I mean, first and foremost, we need ethics and transparency for these justices.
Absolutely. I mean, that just seems like the table stakes to me with everything we've seen over the last few months.
Right? I mean, this is insane to me that they are the one... their lifetime appointments, and they are not forced to basically adhere to any of the other ethical anti-corruption kind of measures that our other elected officials all have to follow. So, you know, if they're not going to adopt their own code of ethics, and I don't think that they should be policing themselves, but Congress has to require it. And there are a couple of bills out there that are looking at this, but, you know, they all include more transparency, rooting out financial conflict and corruption, making sure we know things like who Jenny Thomas is being paid by, yeah. Right? Number two, we need to expose the amount of dark money that's being spent on judicial nominations. The Leonard Leo Federalist Society has spent somewhere around $500 or $600 million in just the past decade to stack the court with these conservative justices. And that same network of dark money then does things like hosts weekend getaways and fancy dinners. And it is clear that there is even if it's not an outright quid pro quo, there is no way that amount of money going into these confirmations is not creating a sense of obligation, right? And then we're seeing these justices actually rule in favor of those same special interests over and over and over again. Number three, so The first one we have are the ethics and financial transparency. Second one is make sure the money being spent is transparent and fully disclosed. Third, we need term limits for future justices. Mm-hmm. I think that would help reduce the partisan influence. It would help bring down that temperature around nomination debates and campaigns. And it wouldn't make it feel like it was the only one that was going to happen in the next 20 years, right, as each of these fights feel right now. And then fourth, we support expanding the number of justices on the court as well. But we support all of that as a comprehensive package. I actually don't think that expansion alone works unless we have some of the others on there, right? Unless we have some of the anti-corruption pieces, the disclosure and transparency, the term limits, like all of it needs to happen together in order to really reform the court. And the court itself should be wanting these reforms as well, because the public has lost faith and trust in them, right? Yeah. The public now views them as another partisan ideological outlet, as just, you know, just like Congress kind of like pox on all your houses. And that is now how the public views the Supreme Court. And that's really, really concerning for their credibility and validity and the ability to make real change in the future. So those are the changes that some of the changes that we have endorsed as an organization.
All right, well, let me see, there are a few minutes left if we can unpack a few of those. So it may be in the order of what would be the easiest to actually implement, pass without constitutional changes or even legislative changes theoretically? Because look, if, like, as you say, if the Supreme Court wanted to have an ethics procedure themselves, they could just do that, right? I take it Roberts could just make that decision mm-hmm. unilaterally even. Is that your understanding of it?
That's my understanding. I what's funny is I almost listed them in the order of ease of which I think they could be done. Yeah. I didn't mean to, but nice, coincidentally, yeah. That's true. Yeah. I mean, the Supreme Court could enact their own code of ethics tomorrow, right? Yeah. And again, if for nothing else than to restore faith and trust in the American public and the credibility of the court with the American public, they should want to. So they could do it themselves. But if they're not going to, then I think members of Congress on both sides of the aisle could find common ground around making sure that at the very least, Supreme Court justices are adhering to the same kind of ethical standards that they have to adhere to themselves as members of Congress. Like, we should at least be able to get that done.
Right. And your understanding is there's no constitutional separation of powers issue with Congress legislating that, right? That's their realm to set up the court system and their realm to pass rules regulating federal courts. That's not running afoul of any separation of powers arguments that we know of.
Not that I know of. I am not a constitutional law professor. But, you know, we know every other federal judge has an ethics standard, right? Like every other division of our federal judiciary system has to follow these. So my understanding is that, no, there is no problems with us enacting that.
So I'm not sure I'm going to get these exactly right in order, but in terms of term limits, that's my understanding. You're going to say this with much more knowledge than me, but that's kind of a gray area of constitutional laws. Is that fair? I think the Constitution uses the phrase good behavior or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is both term limits and expansion. There are debates around what that looks like, but we have seen expansion. I'm going to jump to expansion a little bit in my answer here. We have seen the size of the court change throughout history, right? And there's consensus that term limits are also allowed. And obviously it would be ironic because I'm sure the argument would go up to the Supreme Court.
Right. But Fox Garden,
Congress should be able to put that into place. The other one that we talked about was the exposure of dark money. And that one's easy, right? Like that absolutely could be passed. The Supreme Court has written in opinions, including Citizens United, that we should have full disclosure and transparency. Even very conservative justices like Scalia himself, who have talked about the need for transparency to root out corruption. So that one, absolutely, we should be able to get that.
Well, any one of those things, is, I'm sure you're right that they need to work as a whole, but I just couldn't agree more that we're at this inflection point where the Supreme Court used to be one of those institutions that there was at least some sense that it was removed from the day-to-day political infighting, and we've just completely lost that over the last few years, both in the confirmation process and how these, you know, incredibly partisan decisions have come down.
I mean, as you know, on the through the Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society, you know, they have lists, and they hand over a list, and they say you are allowed to choose from this list, and those lists have been curated and not just vetted, right? But these are judges who have gone through their program and who do the dinners and do the weekends and are, you know, engaged in a lot of their programming in lots of different ways. And so they feel very confident about how they would rule on constitutional matters like Roe.
Yeah, I mean, they perfectly subverted the principles of the Constitution in this regard, right? Like, even if you were to accept that the founders wanted it to be lifetime appointments, and it doesn't sound like that's what it says, but let's just assume the logic in that. The idea is, well, they can change their minds. You can insulate them from the political process, and they don't have to, you know, fear the repercussions or about what future job they're going to get. And that was happening for a long time in our history, right? We had Justice Kennedy, right? And we had justices who evolved dramatically when they got there, almost always to the progressive side. And then the Republicans decided they had enough of that. And they started these lists where they got the answers decades before the folks wound up at the Supreme Court. They've completely subverted these institutional protections, this political insulation concept, right? So if that's not the argument for why something needs to change, where something just doesn't serve you anymore, I don't know what is. You know, it reminds me of the Electoral College, which is just not working. I think we could hopefully all admit that on many levels. When you don't have electors who are allowed to do anything different than the state, which is not why they were put there. So I don't know. I sometimes feel like we're too hesitant to talk about amending the Constitution. I don't think it should be done willy-nilly at all. But the great Jefferson, who's the Australian comedian, his name's Jim Shepherd, who said, people say, you can't amend the Second Amendment. I say, sure you can. It's called an amendment. You know, it's like, I mean, like there is a process for doing these things, right? And I think it's great that you all are willing to have these conversations and some of these really bold things that the time has come for. And I hope you can be successful moving these conversations forward as we get into the next cycle. So thanks so much for coming back on and for everything you're doing. And where can people find more about your organization? And we'll put a specific link to the state report card, but what's your website so people can read more about what you're up to?
Well, it's been such an honor to come back on, and thank you so much. I look forward to the next time coming back on. As we're knee deep in the 2024 cycle, I can't believe we're already saying 2024. How did that happen?
Amazing.
And we'd love for anyone who wants to help fight to save our democracy and get money out of politics, join us. We are at endcitizensunited.org, endcitizensunited.org. Or you can follow us on Twitter. We are at Stop Big Money. And my Twitter handle is Tiffany_Muller. There we go.
Tiffany, thanks so much. Pleasure having you.
Thanks so much for having me.
We invite you to share story ideas, comments, and questions. Find us at NeptuneOps.com or on Twitter at NationStateOfP1. Again, that's at NationStateOfP and then the number one. Follow us and subscribe to listen to all of our episodes as we continue to explore the inside stories driving California policy. Thank you for listening to the Nation State of Play podcast, powered by Neptune Ops.
Media.